After a slow start, Timbald members seem to have more than a casual eye on the forthcoming election as their June order paper advanced. We'll hear on tomorrow's agenda some views on the assisted dying bill, but today we consider a move to improve planning in our territorial sea, changes to national insurance and a stalled move to centralise ownership of government land, and some radical reform to the way in which the budget is presented and agreed. First, though, Chief Minister Alf Cannon answered an urgent question from Julie Edge.
Look, just dealing with the question itself, I accept that even on our island there is a level of concern about security, about the checks for immigration and how our borders are policed. You know, we have not stood still as a government over the last 5 years, putting aside anything that's happened recently. We've merged ports policing with the constabulary. We've brought in ANPR, automatic number plate recognition legislation. We are going soon to consult on facial recognition technology. We've just consulted about the ID requirements on the steam packet. And we've taken every step necessary to react to the challenges, the security challenges that have faced us, and we've put it at the highest level of priority. Even before the incident in Northern Ireland, though, we were considering the resilience of our current operation, whether we were could do better in terms of the liaison that we have with other border forces, particularly the UK border forces, whether we were as secure that as we would like, and whether we were receiving the right intelligence. And the conclusion of that is that we do need to go further. We are going to create a border agency. The first phase of that will be to do the real groundwork in terms of the operating model, the statutory requirements, and a clear plan as to where that agency will sit and how it will be properly managed. And then secondly, of course, then when they move to actually put that into full operation. But there is a requirement to do that work at pace. So we will do that as quickly as possible over the coming months, and we'll be ready for the next government and the new Timbald, I hope certainly by the new year.
Is the Isle of Man actually physically capable of dealing with all these issues? Because as we're discovering, there's a very advanced world out there with all kinds of wonderful techniques to evade and overcome the things that we're trying to put in place. You know, we're a very small country with a fairly limited budget. Are we capable of really putting in place what's needed to stop people exploiting our system?
Absolutely. I mean, I've had the confidence in the in security services and the intelligence and the liaison that we have in terms of identifying the threats. We've been very successful to date in terms of the application of that. A lot of the threat is actually coming from serious unorganized crime, particularly drugs networks that are seeking to infiltrate the island. We can see that the police have taken a very successful and hardline approach to that, which I've completely and fully endorse. And, you know, we do have the capabilities to ensure that we can bring in more security and knowledge around who is travelling to the island and how to look at adding more enhancements to the security process when they arrive at our ports. So absolutely, we can deal with it, Phil. Of course, it's going to require some more investment. But I think the critical point is this. The threats around us are changing. And developing. We know the international situation is very unstable at the moment. We know the threats that are coming from foreign nations that are hostile to British interests in particular, and potentially Manx interests alongside that. We know the threat that's developing from serious and organized criminals, and that includes not only just drugs and day-to-day crime, but also people trafficking and illegal immigration. So we do have to react to it. We do have international exposure, but it's vital that we keep the island safe and secure, both so that our economy can function and function well, but also that we maintain the vital social cohesion that we need to succeed into the future. We will need immigration to fill skills gaps. We will need immigration for investment, inward investment purposes. We will need immigration to support private sector businesses and indeed public sector operations. We need to ensure that we also have the public confidence that the government is taking all necessary steps to protect our safety and security and the safety and security of people and their families.
And you said in answer to one of the supplementary questions, I think it might have been, that you are, the threat level at the moment is at its highest. What does that mean?
Well, that is, we would go off the UK threat, and of course that application on the Isle of Man you would hope is very, very limited. But we know that threat levels are placed at substantial and severe in certain places and areas. I think that really is just reflective of the conversation that we've had in terms of recognising the changing threats about us, recognising both international but also local developments, policies and approaches, and also the level of public concern that is coming through. I think you do need to recognise that. You do need to take positive steps forward and to, I hope, get the public confidence that government recognises some of those challenges and wants to make the right steps, bring forward the right steps to address them.
We're speaking before the assisted dying bill amendments are extraordinarily moved in Tynwald. You have been accused by a former MHK, Quinton Gill, of playing politics in relation to this matter, in relation to some of your comments to Tynwald. Is that fair?
No, not really. I mean, Quinton Gill, I think, is a timely intervention to try and sow some discord and animosity, I think, before this quite serious debate that's taking place, and chose to selectively quote some of the things that I had said in the past. Look, you know, I retain my position, particularly as a private member, to speak without fear or favour, to represent the views that I believe are appropriate and correct. I retain my position with regards to this legislation in that it is fundamentally not fit for purpose, and that it would need a substantial amendment if it was to be put into a place where I think we could all be confident it was going to work properly for people. I don't think Quinton Gill had the right really to try and criticise a parliamentarian who was frankly expressing their views. And you know, this has always been a private member's bill. I have given free rein to council and ministers to express their opinions. I've maintained my position, and I'll continue to do so.
It is extraordinary, isn't it, to have a bill amended in this way. I mean, it's highly unusual, to say the least. And particularly a bill as controversial as this. Are you surprised that this is the mechanism that's being employed to move these amendments?
Well, I think the mechanism is set out in the standing orders in terms of how Tynwald should adapt to concerns that are expressed from the Ministry of Justice. I think there is a view, and one that I would probably support. I would prefer a longer time to deal with this. I think it should have probably gone back through the House of Keys ideally, and that we should have had another go at really building the resilience into that legislation that is absolutely needed, even though fundamentally there are significant parts of that I still cannot support. We are where we are. I think it's clear the majority view is this bill should go through. I expect it will go through, and you know, it'll be up to the next government to pick it up and to build out where the deficiencies are, and to try and somehow bring it into operation or bring forward new legislation if indeed that is the case, and that is what is needed to enact this.
That was Aaron Michael, MHK, Alf Cannon. Next, Onchan MHK, Julie Edge. You had a victory of sorts in relation to your motion regarding the territorial sea. What was it specifically you were trying to get?
I was trying to get protection for the island for the future generations, actually, with regards to the national asset that we have, which is our territorial seas, and that we needed a national framework to protect that, to ensure that instead of the arguments we're seeing at the present time with regards to whether wind turbines should go there, whether they're going on land, that we had a proper framework in place for the island, for its future, to make sure everybody understood that, could debate it, could have a discussion about it. It was given Comin, I felt, the option to look at a vision for our island. We've got national assets that we haven't got a national strategy for, and I find that incredible for them then to just go from a marine spatial plan that they think covers what I was requesting. Well, why didn't you go for what I was requesting? Because it included a marine spatial plan. It's a very bizarre outcome, I personally feel, and not the future strategy that we need for the island and vision that we've seen in past administrations and certainly past governments, back in the day.
And the marine spatial plan, I mean, it certainly comes as a surprise to me that 10 years after I left DOI, that still hasn't been done, because it was certainly the intention. And at that stage, I think there were policies and plans as to what we wanted to do with the territorial sea. Perhaps they should have been better communicated at the time, but I think perhaps the understanding was that this was about to happen in the next administration.
Yeah, and this is it again here now, aren't we? We're here 10 years since you've been out of politics. We've got a department saying, well, we're doing a bit of this. Then we get a member of the department standing up saying, well, DOI are doing that. That's exactly my point, that if we had a national framework and strategy around our territorial seas, the benefits that we could gain for the people of the island and use our resources to our benefit, instead of what currently the public actually do feel is it's getting used for developers' benefit. And my point is, protect our island, protect our territorial seas, maximise the asset and the profit from that.
And all this matters because 85%, so somewhere in the region of 85% of the Isle of Man's territory is the territorial sea. And obviously, you'll be aware in Onchan that there is a big development being proposed just off the coast, off the northeast coast of the Isle of Man, wind farm development there. There has been talk about gas extraction, although that seems now to have gone into abeyance. But the territorial sea has the potential of developing significant income for the Isle of Man government.
And as I said in there today, other jurisdictions are now recognising the importance of the territorial seas and the traffic and movement and the possibility of cables, offshore wind, energy, everything through it. You know, the Taoiseach has just said we need to protect this asset. We need to come up with a strategy. My motion was in well before that. We've seen the success it's been for Norway by having proper strategy in place, and we haven't got one. Honourable Member that moved the amendment, she thinks a marine spatial plan is the solution. I want to see a proper national strategy and framework for our territorial seas, for not this administration. It won't be for the next, it's for the future generations. And let's make sure we can bring that downstream revenue from our territorial seas back to our island for our individuals. Wouldn't it help with possible housing crisis? Wouldn't it help our hospital? Wouldn't it help our education services? I'm not seeing that from a marine spatial plan. I did mention the Marine Infrastructure Act because I don't believe it covers fiscal. We've heard the Treasury Minister say that they've got revenue for they've got a tax strategy for hydrocarbons. I'm not just talking hydrocarbons. I'm not just talking what they can see today, whether it's a wind farm or hydrocarbons. I'm talking about the whole asset, whether that's our fishing industry. I used the example of Iceland. They taxed the fish that were being taken out of their waters, and that's been successful for them. We're giving out fishing licenses for a boat for something around about, I believe, £600. We're wasting, we're giving our assets away, and I want to protect them for future generations.
A marine spatial plan, though, is at least a victory of sorts, in as much as to create a marine spatial plan,
there will have to be some strategic thinking going into what needs to go where in that plan. I mean, effectively, the marine spatial plan is the marine equivalent of what we have on land in our planning system. So it's a good second best, surely.
Well, it's better than nothing, isn't it? But let's hope, you know, I hope I have the opportunity to take forward what my idea is and make sure if that marine spatial plan does come forward, as you say, we've been waiting 10 years. Well, hopefully we won't be waiting another 10, but, you know, given the opportunity, I would still be going for a national framework and strategy around it, because it's not, you know, in the future, we could be talking about drones under our seabed and things like that. They've got to think ahead, and I'm not seeing that vision, to be honest. I didn't see it in there today. It was quite shocking how many people took part in the debate when it's the strategic asset that we haven't actually benefited from today.
That was Onchan MHK Julie Edge. Treasury Minister Chris Thomas welcomed the amendment.
Council ministers supported the amendment whereby we need to have a marine spatial plan. And also, Julie Edge made the right point that we also need legislation for taxation, legislation for health and safety and all of those things to come forward. I think she has missed a few things that are there. For instance, we do have a taxation regime for hydrocarbons. In my budget, I floated a draft, the idea of one for alternative energy sources. So, yeah, we made progress. I think government was pleased too with the way that motion ended. The other important thing is that by the 16th of June, Treasury DOI had to submit evidence for the for session four, I think it was called, of the MEMA examiners session. And that paper's up there now. Really interesting read. 15 pages written by Treasury answering the very specific questions about economic benefit, taxation. And there's also some commentary from the Department of Infrastructure in one of their papers about the agreement for lease. In essence, they haven't published the agreement for lease as far as I found as yet, because I don't see these except from the website after they've been published. They're officer submissions from Treasury and from DOI. But essentially, the agreement for lease is about an area that's been leased for certain things to be done with a view to putting in a lease. And what the submission from DOI says is the amount of electricity that will be generated is blank at this stage. It's to be added in when the lease is put in place, if there is such one, which I think is what I assume to be the case, although I've never seen the agreement for lease.
What seems to be a debating point, at least at the moment, is whether government income is a valid planning reason, and I don't know. I mean,
and that's what the 15 pages are about.
So, and Treasury, what is the conclusion?
Well, Treasury says things like it can't comment on what planning cases in across mean here, because that's obviously for the planning experts. But Treasury does give further information about how it's about how, you know, what's been said by Treasury politicians in the past, and a bit more about the modelling process. So, for instance, it cites the motion that you took through back in 2014. It cites things like the energy strategy. It cites what the Treasury Minister said in the 2024 budget and in the 2026 budget. So it's that sort of document. I strongly encourage everybody who's concerned about this to have a read.
OK. Then one of the other... there was a few items that looked fairly innocuous at the end of the order paper. One, which you got through largely unscathed, which was about national insurance. So maybe if we start with that.
Yeah, so that I've exchanged letters with a minister across, and now I've done what we said we would do in that exchange of letters, which is we've taken through to get Tim Ward agreement to a new convention, amending the old one about how contributions are made. So making it clear where you pay contributions depending on your situation in the Isle of Man or the UK and who keeps them, with some exceptions, with everything covered, but with some differences to a standard UK agreement around mariners. So very important, very boring, but it's been in train for about 10 years and we've made good progress. And as long as the Privy Council approve it across, from 1st of April, we'll have complete clarity for the sector. Now we've got it through in the Isle of Man, we'll begin preparing the dialogue we have with all the payroll firms, with people, to make sure that by the time we get to 1st of April, there are no surprises.
The other item that was adjacent to that item on the order paper, of course, though, was the idea of bringing all government property into one ownership.
Yeah.
And it is fair to say that you were getting quite a rough ride when eventually the Chief Minister said, well, let's put this off for a month to give people more of a chance to understand what's going on. Laurie Hooper was, I think, laying into the Treasury.
And that was unfortunate. He had been, even on the previous day, he had been sitting there talking with Attorney General's Chambers staff. There is disagreement about his interpretation of what the law means. It wasn't the Chief Minister as such, it was the whole of Council Ministers. We decided the best thing to do was to adjourn until next month so the same paper will come back. Obviously, we've got opportunities to do various things between now and then. I've had meetings about that. So I'm very pleased that this very important initiative carries on in July.
But have you got it wrong?
Well, even Laurie Hooper would admit that the direction was right. He's worried about several things, one of which was the government estate authority wouldn't be in the Freedom of Information regime. But you will remember the Freedom of Information Act allows a schedule to be consulted on to include this body into the Freedom of Information regime. That's not how it was done for the Manx Care. The last statutory board was created. That was on the face of some primary legislation that the Manx Care Bill would be in that side of that schedule. This time, you know, there's absolutely nobody who doesn't want to include this in the government estate authority. So I didn't want to fight with him that day, but we want it included in the regime. So we'll be making that clear. Another point he made was the Government Property Trustees Act is 1971, before the Council of Ministers was created. So he's making a big point that this Tim Ward is being substituted in the Government Property Trustees Act for Council of Ministers. That's correct, but last year, I took out board in front of Treasury for the similar basis, because the Treasury Act is 1985, before the Council of Ministers was created, and the Council of Ministers is accountable to Tim Ward, to the House of Keys, and that's the new way of doing it. There's nothing sinister about it. The statutory board is still accountable, like other statutory boards, to Council Ministers, and Council Ministers and ministers are still accountable to Tim Ward. And finally, he's got some technical points about housing and local authority housing, and I will be engaging properly with every member and the public about these issues up until we have the adjourned debate restarting again.
It does feel perhaps a little hasty coming forward. I mean, obviously, in the past you've been accused of spending too long scrutinising and coming up with reports and ideas. And maybe it's a bit rich of me then suggesting that you're being a bit too hasty. But, this was only really agreed as a thing that needed to happen a few months ago.
And there was no timescale on it. You were surprised to learn we planned to do it in June. But as you know, in Manx, my name now is Thomas Tarvey, Thomas Fleetofoot. No, but the point is we've learned the lessons of something like Manx Care. Manx Care started based on statute and then has had teething difficulties once the statute's in place. And now we're having to look to amend the Manx Care Act to put in place an ability to amend the way that the governance structures. The One Government Estate project is a project that will still run regardless of the outcome of the result till 1st of April 2027. Everybody's agreed that we don't do these things as well as we should do. And so therefore, some of the issues about the territorial seas, about housing, about all the things that Laurie was having, just pronouncing about, which I challenged him on, given that he was speaking differently from what he's heard from the Attorney General's chambers, we'll have the chance to review those during the coming few years. Laurie was right that the tiered structure is not defined in statute, but that's purposeful because we want to make sure we get it right. Mm. So the debate carries on, and we'll be working with members to ensure we have 13 members who support us in the House of Keys, 4 or 5 in the Legislative Council. Hope to get that. If not, so be it. We can start again after the election. But essentially, government estate is hugely important. We've got 1971 legislation. We can get so much savings out of the way that we manage the maintenance. You know, nobody's denying that we need to do more in terms of maintenance. We can get so much more out of the government estate by taking an overview, holistic view of the buildings that we need and the other property that we need. So it's a good direction. Yeah, the debate wasn't very pleasant. I perhaps didn't handle it as well as I should, but we've adjourned and we'll come back in July.
That was Douglas Central MHK Chris Thomas. Speaker of the House of Keys, Ewan Watterson had his 20-year political ambition fulfilled this week with big changes agreed to the budget process.
A committee established to review the budget process, of which two former Treasury ministers, one current Treasury minister and the chair of the Public Accounts Committee were members. So, Mr. Speaker, you're the one of those mentioned, and you haven't been a Treasury minister, so...
I imagine that Dawn Kiddish was sitting very uncomfortably during part of it, if you look at how many Treasury ministers and ex-Treasury ministers were on the committee.
Yeah. So what was the conclusion of all this, would you say? Because this is something that you have probably for just shy of 20 years now been trying to achieve.
Yeah, this is something that I've been campaigning for a very, very long time, and almost my entire parliamentary career. And it's a bit of a red letter day to see that Tynwald has actually supported changing, taking back an element of ownership of the budget process. And I won't pretend that I'm not just a little bit shocked and a bit emotional by the results that have been coming through. To win the overall 18-5 ultimately was just, unbelievable.
And what is it specifically that you are trying to achieve from this? Because critics might say what you've done effectively is added extra layers of bureaucracy into a system which is already struggling with the very significant layers of red tape that government finances operate under.
There's no red tape around the budget process at all. It's not even a documented system. That's how bad it is. And Tynwald members who face the electorate are accountable for every decision they make. The biggest one of those is how we spend 1.4 billion of the public's money. And to date, the only decision we have is take it or leave it with this decision. This is going to start changing that. This is going to allow Tynwald members to have more of a say in how that process operates. It have the opportunity to put forward, in a very limited extent, but be able to put forward amendments, a limited number of amendments that must be cost neutral or improve the revenue position of government. So there are checks and balances in there. But these are standards that have been set by significant international bodies and operate around the world, the OECD, the IMF, the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association. These are benchmarks set by them. This isn't something novel and innovative that the committee have just sort of decided to throw in the back of a fag packet. This is international best practice, and that is finally looking like being implemented on the Isle of Man.
Should all Tynwald members be experts in scrutinising every detail of government finances, or should they be able to rely on finance officers either within the parliamentary structure or within the government structure to give them advice?
I think it's very important that when members vote on a budget, they can say that it reflects in some part the priorities that they have said are important to them, to the electorate. That's not something that's available in the current system. So there's an element of that. In terms of where they get their advice, I think there is advantage in being able to take advice from outside of the Treasury offices. You don't get people to mark their own homework. And that will help people understand it in a more impartial and neutral way so that they can come to an informed decision as to what is going on with the money that they are being asked to authorise on behalf of the taxpayer.
But as politicians, your primary role is to try and deliver on the priorities that you set out in your manifestos, and perhaps getting into too much of that detail means that you then don't have time to work up all the novel and good ideas that need to be worked up. You know, if you are there purely scrutinising government finances, are you then losing the ability and the time, I suppose, to be able to innovate and come up with the big ideas that will hopefully shift the dial in terms of where Isle of Man government is at the moment?
Not at all. The budget's 1 month in the year, and having the budget document out there just a couple of weeks in public before it's actually voted on gives everyone the opportunity to look at it. That's not a whole year consumed looking at government finances. I mean, much as that would give me no end of fun, that's not what I believe the job of every single politician on the Isle of Man is. We have a public accounts committee that has quite a wide and varied role, everything from looking at the accounts after the event to looking at budgets and estimates as well. So there is a role for committee work in this and coordinating that effort with support to scrutinising that in a coordinated way. The policy review committees can add to that as well. But you can't do that in a vacuum, and that's what we've got at the moment. The budget is secret until it is released, and then we're expected to vote on it the same day. There's no way that the public even get a look in on that to ask some obvious and pertinent questions about where their money is going before the deal is done, the decision's made, and everyone has to move on and deal with something else. So having some time in the calendar to look at public finances is important. That's not to say that it needs to be an ongoing battle the whole year round.
So in a nutshell then, effectively this is about allowing Tynwald to have more say, so that when they go out to the electorate, well, particularly in this case the Keys members go out to the electorate want to hold them accountable for the financial decisions, and yet as things have stood, they have very little say in what goes in the budget and what they agree to.
That's right. So it will be a step up in terms of, you know, that responsibility, that accountability, that ability to sort of test some of your own priorities and bring them forward at budget time and make sure that the money follows the results, because the two are intrinsically linked. That's part of what I think the attempt was with the departmental reporting processes, is to try and start to link where the money's going with the outcomes that are being achieved for that money. Well, this then allows Tynwald at least some say over the money side, as well as just sort of setting policy. And that then is going to drive a sense of responsibility, whereby the if you're going to decide the policy, you also need to work out what the financial priorities are as well. So it will increase the responsibility of Tynwald members in this area, because no longer will they have the take it or leave it approach in front of them. They will have tools that they can use to make the budget perhaps more sensitive to the what they believe to be the will and needs of the people.
The Treasury Minister suggested that maybe the report didn't have the full support of all its members.
He didn't support it, but then again, he didn't turn up to the last two meetings, and I don't think he didn't explain why. He's claimed in the debate that the report is in some cases wrong without mentioning why that was, either in the committee, in a note since the committee published its report, in the debate. So it does somewhat undermine the credibility of the claim.
So going forward into the next administration, what are we going to, as members of the public, notice that's different to what went on before?
I think you will actually notice the budget. I know that Manx Radio have always done an awful lot to try and raise the profile of it. It's a flash in the pan for a single day, and it lasts for about one news cycle. But that's because no one's had the time to get into it before it's been decided, and then it's old news. So what we will find, I think, is an actual budget debate that will happen in conjunction with the public, in conjunction with other public commentators, around where taxpayers' money is going, where the overall spending priorities are, but also the macroeconomic position. You know, are we doing as well as we thought we were doing? Trying to balance new spending pressures up against the structural deficit that we've had for some years now, and we need to wean ourselves off. These are debates that are actually going to happen, the questions that will actually need to be asked and answered in a way that haven't been able to be done in a timely way before a decision is made in the past.
Who would want to take on the role of being Treasury Minister after the next election?
I would still contend that the Treasury Minister would still be the most powerful job in government, even with these reforms in place. It's undoubtedly now, these do sort of perhaps take one fingernail off the levers of power and give it to Tynwald, but it does not undermine the responsibility of the executive to put a budget together, and nor does it undermine the significant power that a Treasury Minister has in allocating resources and leading that process. And that is just the biggest power in government.
Russian MHK Duan Watterson there. Former Treasury Minister David Ashford was also on the committee.
On the subject of hot potatoes, the next item on the order paper after yours was the Budget Select Committee. And this is trying to allow members to have more say over what is in the budget and what the budget looks like. You were a member of that committee. Indeed, the very fact that two former Treasury ministers and one current Treasury minister were on that committee, this demonstrated a general view that this was something that the establishment should be happy with. You didn't actually speak in the debate, and you didn't support a number of the recommendations.
So in terms of it, I was a member of the committee. As you say, it was an alumni of political membership of that committee. We had the chair of the Public Accounts Committee, two former Treasury ministers and the current one making it up. I didn't speak in the debate because my views have always been well known. I've always stated in Tim Ward that we do need some form of budget budget reform, and that Tim Ward needs to be more involved in that process. I thought what the committee came up with was an excellent starter for 10, but equally I thought the amendment that the Chief Minister brought, which was the same amendment basically for all the recommendations, for it to be taken away, examined by government and then brought back, also did the job. So that's why I was happy to support the amendments, because it is something that needs to be looked at very carefully. The budget is one of the most important processes that Tim Ward goes through, and while the committee has come up with recommendations that I think need to be considered exceptionally carefully, I think part of that consideration should have been council ministers going away and then reporting back. Tim Ward has gone straight for the let's get these implemented situation. That's that's the way Tim Ward's decided to go.
It's extraordinary for a committee not to ask the areas of government most affected by its recommendations for feedback. Why did that not happen?
Well, I think this was more around the process. So it was. So we did have engagement with Treasury. That's got to be very clear as a committee. We did have engagement with Treasury. There was input from government departments as well. I'm a minister as well as being a member of that committee, so I know there was engagement with government. And that was from that the committee formulated its recommendations. But like I say, for me as well, I thought the amendment from the Chief Minister was perfectly sensible because it allowed councillor ministers and government time to look at how we actually reacted and changed things potentially for the better in the budget process. That wasn't supported in Tim Ward. Tim Ward's gone with the original recommendations of the committee, bar one, which Tim Ward voted against. So that is the situation we're in now, and that's the situation we'll move forward with.
That was Douglas North MHK David Ashford. Finally, Treasury Minister Chris Thomas again. Another issue then, and it left me thinking who would want to be the Treasury Minister after this went through, is the change to the budget process, which was suggested by a committee, which included yourself and other former Treasury Minister David Ashford, Duan Watterson as chair of PAC, and the current, well, you are the current Treasury Minister, yeah, and the previous Treasury Minister, Alex Allenson, was Dawn Kinnish on the committee.
Dawn Kinnish was the fifth member. Yeah.
Are you content with all these proposals that have been introduced?
Well, we never, council ministers never expressed opposition to them. They just looked for proper reflection on it. Before I start on that, we're moving at speed, and we do want to make changes, and we are making changes, and we accepted some important recommendations. But before I start, just think of my poor position and the Treasury Officer's poor position, which is just before the committee of which I had to continue being a member, because it's not for me to go into personal details, but often it was necessary for me to be there just to make sure it was quorum. You need three people to be there to make sure it was quorum. There were two people who were most strongly involved, and they always needed a third person to agree with them. I was a prisoner in the own committee, reflecting on what I used to say about the Chief Minister being a prisoner in his council of ministers. But in essence, a set of recommendations have come up. It's well informed for the reasons that people have given, and then people started picking on me to an extent, particular members, to say I must agree with it because I hadn't written a memorandum of dissent, or I hadn't left the committee. I didn't think I would get away with leaving the committee, because you have to have a vote in Tynwald to get you off the committee, firstly, and secondly, you don't have to write a memorandum of dissent, you can just dissent. And I couldn't really write a memorandum of dissent as Treasury Minister, because as Treasury Minister I'm speaking on behalf of the whole Council of Ministers and Government, so I'm in a bit of a bind. When inside Treasury they didn't want me to be the person who led this, even though I'm most closely involved in these issues, because that was perceived as a conflict. So, Dr. Allison, so where we are is this. I've always had the view throughout my time in the committee that they should come up with three or five really strong recommendations. They went for what I call the Dewan Watterson approach, as of having loads of recommendations, and the debates are so confusing because there's so many different recommendations. So I always wanted three or five recommendations, and I also wanted to do it properly according to government finance principles. Principle number one in that is you cost everything. That report hasn't been costed, wasn't even exchanged with Treasury for factual accuracy, and there are some factual inaccuracies.
That in itself is something that is, well, it always was standard procedure. If you were criticising someone or you were asking someone to make significant change to the way they do something, you would give them the opportunity to see the report before that's published.
Well, that didn't happen, but that is what we did for the waste strategy from the Environment Infrastructure Committee. So committees can do that. That committee didn't. The second point is, the whole point of being in Treasury or Treasury Office is to be prudent with the national reserves. And I quoted Moody's to say one of the good things about the Isle of Man was we had a good governance system, fiscal confidence was there. And I said that was at risk, so we should do things prudently. And in Council of Ministers this week, we agreed that we were right to press the no button, just so that people would see that we were being prudent. And I don't think the impact of the
And of course the report wouldn't have gone through had it not been for the fact that one of your ministers was unable to attend Tynwald due to a personal issue. And another member who often supports council ministers wasn't present on that day either. Suddenly it would have been 12-12 and not 12-10.
All that's true. But most importantly, we had a really good meeting in the Brule Suite, and some of the senior ministers were strongly involved. And the feeling in that room was that council ministers' position was really, really sensible. It just so happens that two or three of the loudest voices who spoke in the debate weren't at that Brule Suite briefing. So the Mr. Hoopers and the Mr. Speaker, Dewan Watterson's, weren't at that meeting. So it was a completely different tone when we got to the actual chamber. So where we are is, I don't think it's affected any budget. And I do hope that Treasury now, I know they are because I've started it in the last couple of days. We're now, you know, preparing a process to make sure we don't lose what we've got, which is 40 years of financial stability and the need to tackle the largest challenges we've had for many decades urgently. So we can't afford to lose focus on that. So we're now going on to make sure that the budget that we deliver according to the Tynwald recommendations, but it's part of a process that would have also been captured by the Council of Ministers amendments. So in that sense, I don't think anything's changed, and I think there was a bit of a nod to that from some of the things that Mr. Hooper and Mr. Watterson said, which is that we're not really speeding you up. And
And the amendments basically were to give more time to council ministers to consider things, basically.
So, and I'll give you another example.
And they all failed, or did one succeed?
Yeah, basically, you know, important amendments were that the public accounts committee and the other committees should do their job well. We completely agree with that. You know, the National Insurance Fund hasn't really been reviewed by the committees. That's an absolutely major part of it. We completely agree with that in government, and we've got another. There'll be more reports in July about this, because we're laying a public audit reform report before July Tynwald. We expect the Tynwald Auditor General report to be laid before July Tynwald. We're expecting the Public Accounts Committee to lay its closing report, which will cover Treasury issues. So we want the new members to become as informed as possible about these issues, and then we'll make rational choices for the budget after the next one. The next budget is in train already, and we think we're going through a well-informed budget reform process, and as a candidate in the election, I will be making sure that the public understands that they need a budget, because there's all sorts of implications of what we do. So, for instance, all of a sudden, you know, your pension could become at risk because an amendment could come through in 6 weeks to change the way that your pension is affected. You might have been expecting a new primary school, but at first sight, it looks like that comes down entirely to amendments on the floor. So at first sight, the people through their representatives being involved in the budget looks obvious. But what Council Minister has stressed through Minister Paul Wilson and others is that you need to have accountability for the decision. There needs to be a coherence of the overall package. And when if the committee really means that tax rates and national insurance contribution rates are going to be varied during a budget debate that Tuesday, we will not be getting the same AAA assessment of our of our governance of fiscal processes. It becomes a very, we go back to the 1980s, and I often think at the moment we are looking like we've gone back to the 1980s.
And I suspect that none of the members who were very strongly supportive of the measures would want that to happen. So, they'll be looking for things to happen in a sensible way. But are you basically saying then that because of what's been agreed, it's possible that this is going to happen?
The legislation has to change. That takes time. The public hasn't been involved really in this process of budget reform, so it will be an election issue, and it needs to be carefully considered. So, we need the accounting community, the banking community, the firms, the people to start thinking about this. Now, there's a possibility of quite a significant and sort of fundamental change. And there's more inputs to it with the report we've done on public audit reform, with the report that we expect from the Tim Wood Auditor General, because after 3 years, he's supposed to report back on the savings that he's identified. So there's lots more to come. And this is a very important part of the forthcoming public policy debate.
The first thing that happens in July, Tim Mulder, is you'll be electing a new president. I mean, obviously, you've ruled yourself out of that, or maybe you haven't.
I
mean,
no, I have. I hereby rule myself out of being a president, but I am a candidate for the Douglas Central in the House of Keys, and Peter Shimmins also indicated he's standing, and there will be other people standing as well.
So in terms of that president role, I mean, what makes a good president? And obviously,
from my point of view, what makes a good president are two things. The first one, that people perceive that person it's got the skills for the job. So I'd be looking for somebody who's been in Tim Wood 10 years or so. Lawrence Skelly did a good job after having been for 10 years. Somebody who's chaired the committees. So I'll be looking for somebody who's the chair of the commissioners, chair of the council, deputy speaker in the past. They're all good possibilities. So we've got candidates like Duan Watterson, Anne Corlett, perhaps Rob Collister, perhaps David Ashford, perhaps Tim Crookle. We've got a whole range of people that meet that criteria. But the second one is that you need to be politically neutral. And so I've got strong views that, to be fair to himself, Mr. Watterson shouldn't go forward for an 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th and 15th years of being a presidency, because he's a political person.
I mean, all the names you've mentioned are politicians, so they're all political.
You have to be an elected member of either the Legislative Council or the House of Keys, the elected member.
So you can't just pick on one member and say, well, I don't like his politics, so I don't think he should stand.
I didn't say that. What I said was that you have to be apolitical, and my view formed over 13 years is that Mr. Watterson is actually an incredibly political person, and you were there through the whole of the Tim Wood sitting, and it is quite he's quite interventionist in what he does.
But that's his job. I mean, that's what he's supposed to do.
So this is the strange situation, and I've said it over a number of years, it's not a new position from my point of view. Basically you have to be neutral as speaker for 3 weeks out of each month, and then the fourth month you get to be a little bit political so you can get re-elected. We need fundamental reform of that, but he's gone too far in terms of being political on the fourth week each month, in my view, to me, to support him as a candidate. And I know he's now got different politics from me. That might be what upsets him. We've had a bit of a going backwards and forwards over the assisted dying we obviously have over the budget now. Fine. Good luck to him. it's got a vision for the future, that might be the right vision for the future, but that's what elections determine. If you're a politician, you shouldn't really be looking for to be president, neutral presiding officer, especially at his age.
That was Douglas Central MHK Chris Thomas. So what do you think? Is the shift in focus on transparency risking officers' ability to actually deliver? Or is it high time Tynwald had more say over how government spends our money? There's not enough time to fit everything in this week, so I'll be returning to June Tynwald on next week's programme. There's a full list of candidates so far declared for September's House of Keys election on Manx Radio's website. Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting philgorn@manxradio.com and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast. I'm Phil Gorn. Goramayos an geistachrom. Thanks for listening.